Hi, I'm Abby Ellsworth. I'm a civilian interviewing law enforcement from around the country. My goal is to tell the real stories of law enforcement, the ones that don't make the news. Today, I'm joined by Dexter Pitts. Dexter is well known to many of you as the author of I Am Pitts, Memoirs of an American Patriot, and his I Am Pitts podcast. Whether you know Dexter or not, you'll definitely enjoy this interview. Dexter is a decorated, medically retired U.S. Army veteran who proudly served with the 10th Mountain Division in Iraq in 2004 as a machine gunner. We talk about the incident that nearly took his life and for which he received the Purple Heart. We then get into his early days in law enforcement and the struggles he was experiencing at the time. A broken marriage, the devastating loss of his mother to suicide, his path toward attempting to take his own life, and how he was able, through the help of family and his command staff, to turn his life around. What's very clear in talking with Dexter is his passion for law enforcement, a profession he has served for 15 years and counting. He started with the Louisville Metro Police Department, known as LMPD, and is now with a smaller department in the greater Louisville area. While with LMPD, he served on the Special Response Team, known as SRT, and he completed a two-year special assignment with the U.S. Marshals Fugitive Task Force. 8 years into his time with LMPD, he left to become a U.S. Border Patrol agent in Naco, Arizona. The departure turned out to be temporary. When the riots and protests broke out in 2020, Dexter knew he had to return to LMPD to be with his brothers and sisters on the skirmish line. We talk about how hard it was to get through those nights and days and nights that dragged out well over a year, and the lasting impact of that fragmented time on law enforcement. Dexter, I'm pleased to report, is working on a second book. The working title is Still Noble, Still Needed, A Profession in Crisis. His goal is to support the profession and encourage people to choose it. After all he's been through, that optimism shines through. So Dexter, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Abby. I really appreciate it. Been following what you've been doing for a while, and you do an awesome job of telling our stories. So I couldn't think of a better person to chat with about my experience and what's going on with the profession.
Thank you. Well, I've been following you and thrilled that we met at this time. You are like the ultimate police officer to me. So I've worked very hard on how to say Louisville. So how did I do?
Wonderful. Nobody from here is going to come find you. You did it right. We get awfully sensitive in Louisville about how we say that word. It's crazy.
It's fun to say Louisville. You just kind of swallow your syllables.
Everywhere else is Louisville, and everybody, no, sir.
And then sometimes when you really get going, it's almost Louisville.
Yep, and that's pretty much, yep, all one blurb, Louisville.
Yeah, Louisville. So as I said, I've known of you for quite a while. I've read your book twice. It's a page-turner. It is dramatic, traumatic. It's a very personal story, a very personal journey. And the place where I have to start was your incident in Iraq. And mm-hmm. The part that always gets me is this premonition that you have, because you were right. So I just want to set it up by reading just a tiny bit from the book, and then I'll throw it to you. And you can tell me what the situation was. But you wrote, and you're speaking to your, you don't call them squad mates in the military. What do you call them?
Oh, just my brothers. I pretty much just keep it simple. Yeah.
Okay. Your brothers. You said, I don't know about you all, but something feels off. I have a bad feeling about sitting here in this spot tonight. Then you go on to say that no one else really seems to feel this way, at least at this point. And your lieutenant says, you're going to be fine. And you say, I don't know, lieutenant. I just can't shake this feeling. You say this more than once. You talk about the chill you felt, the hair standing up on the back of your neck. And then tell me about the incident, tell me about feeling that way.
Well, you know, in the book, I tell people, if you go back a little further, like the moment I woke up that day, I mm-hmm. just knew, you know, that there was something in the air and I just couldn't put my finger on it. And we were always told that, hey, if your spidey senses are going off, say something. And, you know, I was saying something, but nobody was really picking up on what I was, you know, feeling. You know, so I was like, man, maybe I'm crazy. Maybe it's combat fatigue and maybe I'm just being dramatic, yo. But it just didn't feel right. And I just knew, like, I knew somebody was watching us. I mean, this is Abu Ghraib 2004. You know, this is right after the incident where the Americans were abusing Iraqi prisoners. Yo, so these people did not like us. You know, so, yeah. I mean, everywhere I walked in that city, I just felt evil stares, like death was just tracking us. And it was only a matter of time before it was coming for us. And, you know, it came. You know, we lost some guys over there at that point in time, you know, but man, it was just, I mean, it was just the worst feeling in the world, just knowing that somebody's watching you, but mm-hmm. you can't see who's watching you, but you can feel them all around you. It's like, so the crazy part is we had been in Abu Ghraib for a couple, I think weeks or a couple months at this point, you know, and so we were kind of getting familiar with the area, you know, but it was just the biggest problem, mistake we made that day was we returned to the same place 3 days in a row. And you never do that in a combat zone because, like I said, this is their neighborhood. This is their city, their home. And they know everything about where they live. Mm-hmm. And my lieutenant made the mistake of going back to that spot 2 days in a row because it was just becoming a habit. You know, but like I said, he was inexperienced in combat. I mean, we all were. Nobody before this, it was only Afghanistan. You know, we hadn't had war since 1991. So we were all learning together. And unfortunately, you know, he made this call, but I talked to him. I still talked to him. He told me that he didn't want to go back to that spot. He told me that he was ordered by our captain. And that's not in the book because I learned this like maybe a year or two ago that our captain told him, no, you will go back to this spot and this is where you will sit. You know, and if you move, I'm going to fire you. Oh. You know, so we went back to that same spot. And, you know, and it was crazy because we had been there the first night. The family that lived there came outside and gave us tea. Yo, and I, at this point in time, I wanted nothing to do with anybody in Iraq. And I'm like, man, this dude done pissed in this tea or something. Like, I don't want nothing to do with anything they had. And they were really nice. Yo, and the next night they came out the second night, yo, and they were like, hey, mister, how are you doing? And yo, and I'm just like, yeah, no, I'm good, homie. I don't want anything. Yo, and they were real nice. And he had kids, yo, and then came back the third night. Nothing. No one was there. Lights was off, yo. And I was just like, yeah. Man, where'd they go all of a sudden? Like, you know, you've been consistent these last two nights and all of a sudden they disappeared. And that was it, man. When we left and came back, in that time that we were gone, the insurgents came back and dug a hole and planted 2.155 artillery shells there. And this is crazy because, man, before we got out and went and parked in that area, we'd always do a sweep and clear. We would go sweep that area and clear, make sure that the ground wasn't disturbed. And I mean, we did our job, but man. And it's just weird to me when I think about it, like just moments before that explosion, like we were literally all standing outside the Humvee, literally on top of this bomb that was under my seat, you know, and we're just sitting there chatting, you know, and I'm just thinking, I'm like, and I always ask God, like, man, what was the dude that was on the trigger that night? Did he fall asleep? You know, what was he doing? You're like, because he had a chance. I mean, he literally could have killed all of us just standing out there, yo, but that gave us time to get back in the vehicle and the vehicle absorbed most of the blast. But unfortunately for me, you know, the blast where it was literally directly up under my seat in the driver's seat of the Humvee where I was sitting, you know. So I caught brunt of the blast, and I mean, it decimated my body. I mean, shattered my left arm. You know, I had my molars cracked in half and blown out. I mean, my back and hips were blown out of alignment and suffered a TBI. You know, I still got a little dent in my skull. It's hard for people to see, but yeah, I got a dent there, you know, and just the emotional trauma from that, you know, and just... Yeah. I mean, people don't realize what it's like to be 19, 20 years old at war, and this incident happens to you. You come to, and you're looking up at the sky, and you know that you're breathing your last breaths on earth. And I'm a man of faith, but you know, at that age, I was just kind of, I wasn't a great man of faith. You know, I struggled with all the things that we struggle with on the surface, but I mean, just at that point in time, man, I just knew I wasn't right with God. And I remember I just started praying because I knew I was going to die. But thank God I survived. And the crazy part is the guy that was like ringing the alarm, sounding the alarm, was the one that got hurt the worst. Everybody else, you know, they got some bumps and bruises, yo, but I was the one that really, really banged up. But, and it's just crazy. I remember when they all got back, and I just told my lieutenant, I was like, hey, I told you, man. Told you so.
Yeah. Well, and what'd he say?
He was like, well, you were right, man. You were right. You know, so. You know, man, that sixth sense is real. I mean, I still get that in police work. Like, yo, like, hey, and maybe it's just me being overly paranoid, but it's just always there. I mean, the day my partner died in December, I think it was December 18th of 21, Zach Cottingen, like, I woke up that day and I remember sitting on my steps and praying because it just something felt off that day. Oh, and then Zach died, you know, and it was just, and so sometimes I still get that feeling and nothing happens, but sometimes I get that feeling that something does happen. It's just, I just feel like God has given us some sort of premonition within us. Like, we just know when things ain't right, man. We know. Mm. It's just like when you know you're talking to somebody and you know they're lying, or you know somebody's trying to hustle you or trying to get something out of you. You just know. Like, you don't have to. You know, it's a spiritual whole warfare thing. And I'm 100% agreeing with what I used to never believe in this type of stuff still until I started having these experiences myself, man. That's not saying I'm like some holistic, you know, voodoo guy, not at all, but I just believe in that sixth sense. Yeah. It's done me well so far.
Yeah. Your fellow officer, I looked up LMPD's line of duty death. So I saw his name. What was his incident?
Zach Cottingen was hit and killed on Interstate on I-64 back in December of 2021. You know, so we literally just moved into our new house. So when he was supposed to come over and help me, and he and I had literally just made a run together, and I arrested this guy with warrants. And I couldn't find the guy's info. Zach was able to find the guy's information for me and sent it to me. And then I just remember him ride off into the sunset. And that was the last time I seen him. And he went up on the interstate to try to get a car towed that had been up there. And some lady, I mean, like I said, it had been raining that morning. It was wet. And this is the eerie thing, Abby. Somebody on the radio early that morning, the shift said, "Hey, it's slick up here. We're going to have a lot of accidents and incidents up here, so be careful." And this lady was coming around the bend, and I guess her car spun out on the slick roadway. Zach was out of his car. It hit him, and he got struck, and we got him to the hospital. And the thing that hurt the most about his death was the doctor said, "Man, he's broken up. I mean, he's beaten up real good, but we think he's going to be okay. You know, he's just going to have a long road to recovery." And I was going to do the next watch on him and sit with him. They're like, "Yo, go home, man, chill out, go with your family." And I remember it was Christmas, close to Christmas time. And me and my wife took our kids to see the lights in our town, you know, the Christmas lights. And we're sitting there and I'm just like, "Man, thank God. I'm glad he's going to be okay." And then my buddy Frankie calls me. He's like, "Man, I got some bad news." I'm like, "What? Like, did Zach go down? Like, did he, you know, is he taking a turn for the worse?" So he didn't make it. I'm like, "Wait, what? He didn't make it?" And man, it just crushed me. I mean, man, I cried like a baby in front of my kids in the car. Yeah. Man, I'm getting a little teary. I'm just thinking about it. But, you know, man, it just that prognosis of he's going to be okay. You know, we're expecting to have this guy around, you know, for the next, you know, 20, 30, 40 years. Yeah. And the next, you know, it changed in a moment, man. And he was gone.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. It's hard.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah. Part of this profession, unfortunately, and he ain't the last, and he ain't the first.
Yeah, I know. There's so many. Well, one of the things that you and I actually connected on when we were preparing to talk is that in 2009, when you were in the academy, you saw the news of the four officers killed in Lakewood.
Yes.
Which is just south of Seattle. The incidents from that time, the ambush murder of Seattle police officer Timothy Brenton on October 31st, and then less than a month later, these four officers. So when you and I were corresponding, you said that was kind of a moment for you.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, you know, I joined the police academy, I believe it was November 2009, you know, and just, I remember coming into the academy that morning, you know, they just had these pictures and articles pulled up, you know, and they're like, these four individuals just went to work, doing a little morning routine, just sitting, having coffee. And some guy comes in and just kills all of them. And I just remember just seeing the four caskets lined up at the head of the church, you know, and just four officers dead because of one dude. And that's when I realized, I was like, man, I knew what I was getting myself into becoming a police officer, but that kind of really drove it home for me. Like, man, I made it out of Iraq, but who's to say that, you know, I'm going to make it out of this profession. Because, I mean, you just never know. And I mean, man, you just don't think about the happening, you know, but that sticks with me because, I mean, every incident I see that involves law enforcement, you know, where an officer gets shot or get hurt, like, and I see the video, I always take that tragedy and I throw it in my head. And I always kind of remember that because that just tells me, man, don't let your guard down. Hey, remember that incident that happened? You know, so I think about the Lakewood thing all the time because that was such a building block for my career. So even when we go out to eat and lunch, I'm still on alertness looking at people walking around, because it don't take nothing for somebody to just come in, pull out a gun and start shooting. You know, and you're just sitting there eating, you know, eating your lunch, and next thing you know, your life has changed or you're dead. It's a matter of, you know, just always being on alert. Unfortunately, as we used to say in Iraq, the enemy always gets a vote. Bad guys always get a vote.
That's right.
Reaction is slower than action. You know, so we're always behind the gun. But any little advantage you can take to give yourself the advantage of being able to react sooner, quicker, is just, it's going to give you a higher probability of coming out on top. But like I said, you could do everything right, man. Everything you're trained to do, yo. But when your time's up and God's calling you, it's just your time. There's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah. I guess I should ask, what drew you to law enforcement after the military?
You know, it was weird because when I got out, I had no clue what I wanted to do. You know, so it was like most soldiers, just, you know, I wanted to build a life. You know, I mean, I went to school for physical therapy because I remember the guys that helped me get my arm decent, and Walter Reed when I was recovering from being blown up. You know, like, I was like, man, these guys are great and they're helping soldiers. You know, so I was like, I want to become a physical therapist, man. And then went to school and looked at occupational therapy. And I remember sitting in a clinic, just like working with some like really old people, just helping them get their flexibility back. And I was like, this is kind of boring, bro. And then I looked at like going into business, yo. And I was like, man, like, I don't want to be a business dude, man. This ain't for me, man. And I just had no clue what I was doing. I tell people, I'm an idealist. Like when I see something in a commercial, you know, then that commercial strikes me, and then I can see myself in that commercial. Man, that Louisville Metro Police Department commercials popped up, and these guys were, you know, just rolling around, and they had their nice uniforms, and they were kind of like, it was like almost military, the paramilitary aspect. Yo, and I was like, man, I think that might be something dope. And then I remember started watching, it was like Copland and all these shows on TV, and you know, looking at federal agents. Yo, and I was like, yo, maybe I could be a federal agent, you know, and then just grew in me hook, line, and sinker. It was at a point in time though where I was also on the verge of becoming an actor, because I did this documentary on HBO called Alive Day Memories. So I was like, in my mind, I was right. Like, I'm gonna go to New York City and I'm gonna become an actor and become famous. Yo, but I was in Italy with Spike Lee doing a movie as an extra. Yo, and I was just like, man, this is it. But I remember seeing that commercial, and then I called the police department. I was like, hey, can I do a ride along? Man, at that first roll call, just the guys, and this was in the days of, we had all Class A uniforms with the shiny buttons, yo, and the old leather gear, you know, the shiny boots, yo, and like everything was dressed right, dressed. Yo, I was just like, oh man, and just getting in that car, and hey, I'm rolling out and going call to call, and adrenaline was spiking. I mean, and I think it's in the book, you know, one of the first calls we made was a homicide scene, a homeless dude laying in like this park and like this little ditch, yo, and he's got like a belt around his neck and a pin stabbed in his eye, yo. And I was just like, this is gnarly. Yo, and I was just like, yo, I was like, man, I want to do this for the rest of my life. Like, they pay y'all to do this? To roll around with your boys and have fun and run and chase people and fight? And I was just like, man, sign me up. And man, it was everything I've wanted it to be.
Really?
Man, I love this profession. I mean, I tell people without a doubt, yo, I am where I'm supposed to be, and I am doing what God has created me to do on this earth. Like, there's no, I ventured out to do other things, and I'm like, none of that stuff's worked out. Yeah. None of it's brought me happiness. And like I said, when I went to the Border Patrol, that's the most money I've ever made and the most miserable I've ever been. Even as a rookie cop, getting all the crap details and jobs and getting crapped on, I smiled through it because I was just like, yo, this is a dope job. And man, I still have that feeling on patrol 15 years later. Yo, like when I go to work, it's just like, I don't really have days where, man, I don't want to go to work today. I hate this place. I hate command. I don't want to be here. I don't have that feeling. You know, it's not every day where I'm just like, man, this is the best thing ever. There's some days are worse than others. You're like, I had a bad, rough week the other week, yo. And I was just like, man, I'm ready to hang it up and just retire, because I can retire because I'm retired from the military. But after my couple of days off, I was like, man, I'm ready to go back to work. You know, and I mean, I remember when I was in the Border Patrol and I had left the Border Patrol and I was out of work, yo, and I was just sitting at home watching live PD. Like, I used to be that guy. I used to do that, man. And just itching to get back into it. And then finally got back into it. And that's why I was like, man, God, I'm staying right here where I'm at and doing what I'm doing. Yeah. I think I've done enough, you know, I've done enough dream chasing, and I walked away from my blessing, but I was able to get back into it, thank God. And I love this profession, man. I love cops. I love what we do, man. It's the best job on earth. I don't care what anybody says.
Yeah. Well, that's
great. Having a real job.
Yeah. Well, I'm as a civilian appreciative that you've stayed in patrol, because we need officers who have experience out there on patrol. I'm glad that you've done that. I do just want to loop back to two things. One is, you referenced the HBO documentary Alive Day, right? Mm-hmm. It was called, and that was with James Gandolfini, who interviewed you.
That's right. RIP.
And a number of others. And Alive Day, I assumed I knew what it meant. I looked it up. Until many listening obviously know what it means, but what does it mean?
Alive Day is the day that you were like wounded in combat and almost died. And so we started calling it the Alive Day. A lot of guys from our generation, you know, or they also call it, well, getting hurt, going to the Hurt Locker. I got an Alive Day and I've been to the Hurt Locker.
So your early days on, it was what you thought it would be. You were excited. But go ahead.
No, I was just saying, yeah, man. I mean, I'm the guy, I would get off and drive home, listen to the police radio and drive my police car off duty everywhere. And it was just, I've never been so proud. And I mean, oh man, it was just everything. It was a dream come true. Like, bro, I'm the police, dog. Like, what? Can't tell me nothing, man. I am the law.
But, you know, there had to have been tough times too, tough incidents. If I could read another part from your book, that's absolutely a little heavy, but and you've been so cheerful, now I'm going to bring you down. But this was really moving to me. An officer's badge only weighs a few ounces physically, but the true weight of the badge cannot be weighed in ounces or pounds. Instead, the burden and weight of the badge are weighed in the haunting memories of gruesome homicide scenes with blood covering the area like a Picasso painting. Scenes like many fatal car accidents involving innocent families killed by a drunk driver, the stench of decomposed bodies, and the looks on the faces of injured and dead children. So while it's your dream and it makes you happy, there's part of it that has to take something from you.
Absolutely. And every dream has a nightmare component to it. And wearing this uniform is definitely that. I don't know how we do it. You know, I mean, it's just repeated trauma after trauma, yo. And there's good times and good laughs and good moments, yo. But I mean, the bad times in this profession are equally, but I just think you develop a callus being a cop, yo. And just, you know, I'd be sitting here on a dead body for 6 hours, you know, and all of a sudden I get done with that and I can go home and play with my wife and kids and just kind of hang out and just kind of put it out of my mind, you know. But it just becomes a coping mechanism that you have, you know, like, with humor and just horrible, right, dark humor. But right. Yeah, but yeah, you know, I mean, just it's part of the business. Yeah, it's just what we do. And I feel like that's what makes us special, yo, is that the guys that have done this like 25, 30 years, it's amazing what the American police officer does. Like I said, it's a great job, but man, you have to be able to ride the waves that come, you know, because there's going to be good times and then there's going to be bad times. There's going to be times where people remember you and thank you for what you've done. Right. And then there's going to be times where somebody sees you out with your family, maybe, yo, and they're going to be like, man, you're a scumbag. And then, you know, next thing you know, you're going to be burying friends. I mean, it's just, this is I think I've heard somebody call police work the greatest show on earth. It really is, man, because we get to see the worst of humanity, but also the best of humanity in a 10-hour span.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, you know, as you say, you see people on their worst days and then sometimes you help them through and save them. And sometimes the gratitude I've learned comes not just when you've saved someone's life, but it could be just, you know, helping somebody change their tire. And some people come back and say, I've heard officers say people have thanked them for arresting them because it put them on a better path.
You know, it's quite funny you said that, because I told a guy that last night. Like, we had started out almost as a mini hostage situation. Oh. And I get there because I'm H&T certified guy negotiator. So, man, and the next thing you know, like, the guy gives the baby up and he's got warrants. And next thing you know, like, I didn't know, but my sergeant had told this guy, like, hey, he promised not to take him to jail if he gave the baby up. And my sergeant didn't want to go back on his word, you know. So I'm sitting there, the door is wide open, and the guy's there. And I'm just sitting here thinking, like, surely we're going to snatch this dude up and just go ahead and take him to jail. Man, my sergeant was like trying to figure out a way to help this guy get his warrants taken care of. You know? So it was just, I mean, this guy was just coming up with every excuse in the book of why this is this person's fault. That, you know, my trifling ass baby, part of my language. He was like, my trifling ass baby mama got me in this predicament. You know, and I'm like, bro, it's been 4 years since you've had this warrant from 2020 for drug trafficking, homie. He's like, it's just time to get taken care of. And he just would not take responsibility for anything in his life. And as my partner was getting ready to drive off with him, I told him, I was like, hopefully you get sober and hopefully you get this taken care of. And hopefully some years down the road, you look back and say, man, I'm glad these guys took me to jail. He was like, man, I would never thank a cop for anything. And I'm just like, man, you know what? I've heard a lot of people say that, but I hope that because you got to understand, it's not the person necessarily, it's the drugs within them that's making them crazy. And like I said, this guy, nobody grows up wanting to be strung out on drugs. Nobody grows up wanting to be a drug addict. This dude was a one-time high-level playing baseball player. And he hurt himself in high school and lost his scholarship to go play. And when he hurt himself, he ended up getting addicted to pills. Same with me when I got hurt in the military. I was hooked on morphine and Percocets. And I had to quit cold turkey, man. And I tell people that battle with addiction, I can't judge that person just because I was able to kick the habit, you know, because they can't. Like I said, nobody wants that. Nobody grows up wanting to be strung out on drugs, man, but you just lose your life, your path in life. And this guy clearly did. And I was just kind of well wishing him. But when he kind of rejected that, I just realized he's not ready yet and he's not there yet. But hopefully he gets there. And it ruined my night, man. I was supposed to be off at 11 o'clock last night. Went into work early.
Oh, no.
Calling my wife, like, man, what are we going to do when we get home and hang out? And I was all excited and to make that text, like, hey, things just kind of went sideways, baby. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. What shift do you work?
I'm on second shift, so I'm 3 p.m. to 1 a.m., the best shift ever.
Yeah. You know, I know early on in your career in law enforcement, you had some difficult times. Is it okay if I talk about your mom?
Absolutely.
Okay. This is tough. So early on, I think you had just gotten into law enforcement. I'm going to get emotional. It's not even my story. And you talk very emotionally about this in the book. So the way it played out, I believe, is that you initially learned that your mother had been shot.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to the hospital and you think that someone has shot her,
mm-hmm.
right? You think it's an attempt or it's a homicide. And then you learn that it's a suicide.
Correct.
So do you mind taking me through? I'm sorry to bring you down.
No, you ain't bringing me down. I've told the story enough at this point. You know, it's just part of my life, man. It's almost like telling people a movie because it's so crazy. And I've told it so many times, yo, but I definitely don't mind. But so I had literally been on the street maybe two months and just got done with phase A of training. You know, so I was in field training and I was transitioning going to phase B. But in the time of transition, I had to go work a detail, the Ironman detail. And we were stationed on I forgot the name of the road, yo, but it's out here in deep in Louisville in the like super rich neighborhood on the bike route. You know, so we're sitting there. I mean, we're up having a good day, you know, just talking to the people, having a good time, you know, and I remember the day before I just talked to my mom and she and I were planning to get together after the detail and go hang out because we had a strained relationship from my first marriage or second marriage. You know, so we were just going to get together and hang and chill. And I remember the night before I was going to get a cooler to put food in, snacks in for my detail, you know, and I'm driving into my neighborhood, turned on the Leisure Lane. And we had been on the phone. I was like, hey, I'll see you tomorrow, mom. I'll talk to you later. Bye. She says, bye, baby. Then she calls me back like a minute later. Hey, you didn't say I love you. And I was like, hey, I love you, mama. She was like, I love you too, baby. So hours later, I'm on this detail. My phone rings and I answer. And I'm like, yeah, this is Officer Pitts. Like, hey, this is such and such with the Radcliffe Police Department. You need to get to the hospital. Your mother's been shot. And I just remember like, hey, whoever this is, stop playing on my phone. This is not funny. And I hang up the phone. Guy calls back again. And I'm just like, this bastard. I'm like, bro, you better. This is not funny. This is nothing to play about. And I hang up again. He calls again. And I'm just like, well, why is he calling again? He's like, man, this is not a joke. This is a lieutenant with the Radcliffe Police Department. Man, your mother has been shot and she's at the University of Louisville Hospital. You know, and I just remember like my world completely stopped. You know, and I'm just like looking at the guys with me on the detail. I'm like, yo, I got to get to the hospital, man. I got to get to the hospital and I'm in full uniform, you know, and my buddy puts me in his police car. I mean, we shoot off down to U of L. I mean, but he's driving fast. And I mean, I can still smell the brakes because we were, I mean, we were turning corners and tires screeching. I mean, we were getting there. And then I get there and I run through the ER doors. I just remember saying, where's Idella Pitts? Where's Idella Pitts? And they take me back to her room. This chapter of the book is called The Brown Paper Bags because they take me to the room in the ER and she's laying in the bed. Her head's covered with gauze and you can see the blood from, you know, the gauze was crimson red from the blood. And I just remember looking at her hands and the brown paper bags on her hands, you know, and I was like, what are these paper bags on her hands for? You know, I just remember my mom's hands and my whole life, just her hands had always been there for me to love me, discipline me. I mean, to guide me. I mean, I just wanted to hold her hands so bad. And then there, I was just thinking like, man, I'm a cop. I'm a badass. I'm gonna find whoever did this to you and they're going to pay. I start asking about the brown paper bags. Now I'm a rookie cop. I'm not a forensic scientist. So I don't know anything about collecting evidence and preserving evidence. Yo. So it's like, and I was about to rip the bags off. They were like, whoa, whoa, whoa. You can't do it. I'm like, wow. They was like, we got to preserve that for evidence. And I'm like, what evidence would be on her hands? I was like, she was shot by somebody. They was like, well, we're not 100% sure. But so I sit there and then I'm 26 years old. You know, and no 26-year-old goes to work and expects that they're going to have to be put in this situation, you know, to where you have to decide if your mom lives or dies. I'm sitting there in my police uniform. And I just remember flashback to a couple weeks before, you know, like, and the crazy part, all the signs were there. I just never realized it. But she started talking about death a lot more. And I was like, why are we talking about this stuff all the time, man? You know, like, this is like, mom, stop. Like, you're going to live to be an old lady, or you're going to be an old grandma. You're going to die at home in your sleep. You know, so I'm like, man, we don't have to keep having this conversation. But I remember her telling me, if anything ever happens to me, just don't leave me on life support. Just let me go. Just let me go. And I'm like, mom, okay, sure. Yeah, sure. Whatever. And she was like, hey, there's also enough for you and your sister. Don't worry about anything. You know, just let me go. And I'm just like, all right, you just hang up the phone and like, man, my mom's a strong woman of God, been a Christian her whole life. You know? So I'm like, that ain't going to happen to my mom. And the next thing you know, the hospital staff is sitting there looking at me in my police uniform, 2 months out on the street. Don't know nothing about policing. Still learning about life. Don't know anything about life at age 26. I just remember my mom's words in my head, just let me go. And man, when I told them to just pull the plug, man, that... And then I just remember them leaving to go pull the plug. And they came back an hour later. And I will never forget those words from the nurse. Sweetie, she's gone. Man, everything just zoomed. I mean, the world literally stood still. You know, and here I was, you know, in my police uniform. I'm supposed to be the hero. I'm supposed to be the guy saving the world and saving everybody. But I was the guy that now needed saving and now needed answers. You know, it just, man, and the way the police department came around me, man, it was so comforting. You know, it was just and that's one of the reasons why I knew I was where I was supposed to be. I was with my brothers and these guys were family. It wasn't about black. It wasn't about white, Republican or Democrat. It was like, hey, Dexter's our brother. He's one of us. He's a cop. I mean, the way they pulled together and took care of me, man. And I mean, my mom's funeral, I mean, the escort, I mean, they came down and helped. I mean, it was amazing, you know, just, I mean, but you just don't expect to be in that position at 26 years old. You know, I can make life and death decisions for everybody else and their family. I could save everybody else and their family, but I couldn't do anything to save my own mom. And I carried that with me for so long, you know, just because I had no clue that she was struggling with what she was struggling with. No clue.
And what was she... I know from the book, but what was she struggling with?
It's a combination of things. So my mom was born in Mississippi in the 1960s. And everybody knows that Mississippi at that point in time was not a great place. Some might argue it's still not. You know? But my mom was treated different because she was dark skinned by people. And I believe that my mom suffered some sort of sexual trauma when she was younger. Nobody in my family would confirm that, yo, because when I would ask, but, oh, whoa, what are you talking about? You know, I don't know anything about that. But just the way they responded, you know, and just some of the things I heard, I was like, man, but something happened. But so she carried that with her from childhood. And then there was years of abuse, of emotional and physical abuse at the hands of my father. You know? And the crazy part is that I didn't know that my mom was being abused by my father. I didn't know. And the thing is, I knew my dad was controlling. My dad's not a very outgoing person. You know, he's just a very stoic figure, man. The man's an enigma. You know, I tell people, I know of my father, but I don't know my father. Now, you know, he's just a hard man. 20 years military, extremely, extremely Christian, like almost cult like with the church and the Christianity, yo. And so, and then I read her suicide letters, yo, and just everything she endured. But what hurt me most was the fact that a letter my mom wrote, not say a letter in hell, but a message to me, and it was, I'm sorry you went away from your family, and I'm sorry that you feel this way about me, but you won't have to worry about me anymore. And that crushed my soul because, like I said, we had just rebonded and started talking again after we fell out over my second marriage, you know. And I told my mom, like, I'm gonna choose my wife over y'all because I have to have a life and I have to have a wife, mom. And we fell out. We didn't talk for almost a year, yo. So, but I tell everybody that what gave me peace of mind and comfort with my mom deciding to take her life was the fact that this, I knew that when she wrote that about me, that was at our lowest and worst point at the time in our lives, at our 26 years together. When my mom wrote that I had hurt her, I knew that I had hurt her, but I knew that that wasn't the entire story. That was just a small snippet of our relationship. And that happens with people. You know, it happens, yo. But the dynamic changed, yo, when we were so close again and just, man, and we had kind of solved everything and smoothed everything over. And what gives me the most comfort is that last phone call when she says, yeah, you forgot to say I love you, baby. And yeah, I said, I love you. And she said she loved me back. So I knew that when she died, that she died knowing that I love her, and she died knowing that I knew that she loved me, and that there's no guilt for me to have. You know, and the crazy part is, though, man, like after she died, I remember asking to go visit her in the back room before they had cleaned her up. They was like, "You don't want to see her like that, you know?" And just, I was like, "Man, I got to see my mom. You know, I don't care." And I just remember going in and looking at her, and you can still see the blood in her hair. You can see where the bullet had entered the side of her head, exited through her eye. And you would think that that would give me nightmares and haunt me forever. I have not had one single nightmare about my mother and her suicide. Not one. Because I have peace from God and I have assurance knowing that she loved me and I loved her, yeah, and she knew I loved her. So regardless of what some of my family members might think, like my sister, who I haven't talked to in 14 years because of all this and everything that went on, you're like, I don't carry any guilt. I have regrets that I wish, you know, we wouldn't have had that rough patch in our relationship, yo, but it's life and it happens. But we made things right between us before she left this earth. And mm-hmm, I rest all my assurance on that I'm going to see her again.
Yeah. Well, and I know too, having lost people in my life, it's really the totality of your life together. That 1 year isn't the relationship. It's the totality, mm-hmm, of your 26 years together. Yeah. And your that opportunity to say I love you.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. Sorry.
No, you're fine.
But you then, not long after, found yourself in a similar mental state where you wanted to end your life. And yeah, was it a result of her suicide or was it a combination of things?
As we say in police work, it is the totality of the circumstances. And they were all, my life was already frayed, you know, from, you know, trauma that I suffered when I was a kid. And then from trauma I suffered in Iraq in the military. And then it just trauma I was dealing with in my second marriage. I mean, it was a horrible, awful marriage. And crazy part is my mama warned me. She said, don't marry that girl. She's going to break your heart. I might not be allowed to see you, Dexter, but she is not the one for you. And man, was my mother ever right? And that's why I wish I was like, man, that old lady was, she knew what she was talking about. Like my life just spiraled instantly out of control. You're like, man, everything I had was like gone. Like I felt like I had built this false fake life that was on a shining hill, this palace built of cheap glass, you know, and that everybody would look up the hill and be like, man, that dude's got it all together. You know, but little did they know, one rock or one strong wind, the house of cards came falling down and everything I had built went away. Everything I know my whole life, I lost my family, my dad, my sister, finito, gone. I don't have anybody else. My marriage was falling apart. Found out that my wife at the time was cheating on me. Yo, so that was gone. You know, and the only thing I literally had was my job. But I was work after my mom's suicide. I went back to work 2 weeks after my mom's suicide because I'm like my father where, like, you know, I'm a man and, you know, nothing bothers me, nothing hurts me. And I just remember going back to work, you know, and thinking, I'm just going to work through it all, man. I don't need help. I don't need counseling. I'm a man. I'll be all right. You know, and at this point I had walked away from the church too. So the church had turned their back on me because the church was associated with my wife's family, who was a big time major component in the city. Yo, so yo, I had nothing. And so I'm at work and I should not have been working because mentally, the worst thing you can do as a cop is get in a car knowing that you were not fully mentally turned on and available. I was running amok in my city with the gun and I should not have been armed because I was a loose cannon and I was putting the citizens in danger, myself in danger, my partners in danger. You know? And I knew that one point in time that was after an argument with my ex, with my wife at the time, we were separated. But I remember I was just like, I remember pulling out my gun and putting my gun to my head and I took the slack out the trigger, yo. But I was like, man, I just couldn't do it. And I was like, man, I'm scared to do it. And I was like, man, I don't want people to think I'm a coward because I killed myself. So I came up with this elaborate scheme in my mind that I was going to be like the scumbag cop to treat everybody bad. And if I treated the right person the wrong way on a traffic stop, surely they were going to kill me. And so that way I can be shot and killed in the line of duty. That's actually how I opened my book up. Yo, it was just right. I'm on this traffic stop, yo, and I'm just like, man, I remember talking to this dude and just kind of dogging him, just not being a good cop, just being a horrible person, you know, just hoping I pissed this guy off. And I just hope that this guy was a felon and that I could talk enough trash to him, you know, that and be disrespectful enough that I turn around, that this dude gets out and shoots me, you know, and just kills me. And then I would be an officer killed on the line of duty. And I remember in the book, I said that to this guy, you know, to the community, he would be a monster. But to me, he would be my personal hero. You know, and I mean, I tried everything to get myself killed because I was a coward and couldn't do it myself. I mean, we would get burglar calls and you never go in a house by yourself, man. I would go get these calls and I'll run into a house where there's a suspected burglar, go in and clear the whole house by myself. Like I had tombstone courage and I was just literally, I mean, putting people in cars and that searching them. Now, knowing that if I don't search this guy and he's got something on him and somebody else takes this guy from me, he's going to kill them. Well, they're not the one that wanted to die. I did, yo. And just, I was a loose cannon for so long. I mean, it was my sergeant who pulled me aside and he realized like something's wrong with this cat. I just remember sitting down there at the Thornton O'Kane Run Road and we went 69 and in the cars where we pull up next to each other and we talk, you know, and he was like, bro, what the hell's wrong with you? Because I had an accidental discharge with my shotgun on a call. An accidental discharge with a shotgun. And he was like, dude, you're infantry, army infantry. You've been to Iraq. I know you know how to handle a freaking gun. He's like, you're running around clearing buildings by yourself. Dude, nobody likes you right now. Nobody trusts you because they think you're going to get them killed. Yo. And he's like, what the hell is going on with you, man? I had kept all these feelings and emotions bottled up inside me on this all of a sudden, man. I ain't never cried in front of another grown man like that in my life. And it just all came out of me. I mean, it just everything. I just started crying, man. I was so lost, man. I mean, my family was gone. My marriage was gone. You know, like, and in my mind, I'm about to lose my damn job. You know, I'm still within my year of being a solo officer and still being on probation. So I'm like, man, they about to fire me. Damn. So we go back to the station and, you know, and we talk to my major, man, my major Chris DeFek. He was actually on my podcast in like the first year. And I mean, man, I'm expecting these guys to just rip me in half, you know, and just tear me a new one. And they wrapped their arms around me like, dude, we know you're a good officer. He was like, man, you need to go take care of yourself. Just touches my heart because, man, I just saw how much these people care. And one of them, man, his name is Major Bates. Major Bates is, we call him Batman because of his voice. And he's just kind of a robot. You know, like, there's no emotion. And he didn't really have any emotion, but just the way he was talking to me was like, you're a good man, Dexter. He's like, yeah, hey, we're going to grant you leave. And I was just like, what? And they told me, dude, 30 days, no questions asked. Go take care of yourself and figure things out. And so I got in my car and I drove to Milwaukee to where my mom had been living with her family, you know, within her earlier years, yo. And I went and surrounded myself with my mom's family. I was able to, I'm not saying get the answers, but I was able to kind of make peace with my life at that point in time. You know, just, and I remember that whole trip, man. I took my mom's photo. And I set it next to me in the driver's seat, you know, and I just made this drive with her to Milwaukee back to where she was from, you know, and I just remember just talking to my family and just reminiscing about my mom and the good times, you know, and it was so powerful, you know, and when I came back, I just felt like I was a new man. Like I had just made the peace I needed to make. And I still had to rebuild my life. But where it all came to me was, I've been brought up in the church and I knew, you know, I was supposed to, you know, always serve God. But like I said, I went away from the church because the church hurt me and turned it back on me. And, you know, at that point in time, I realized what I had to, I needed to get back in the church and I needed to get a relationship with God, you know? So I start doing all that, man. And little by little, I started to build my life back up into what it is now. You know, and I mean, it was a uphill fight. You know, and I'm telling people, when I say it was an uphill fight, every day was a struggle to get out of bed. And the biggest thing I had to do was I had to change my reputation from what I had built it into to being somebody unsafe that people couldn't work with and people that officers couldn't trust because I was a loose cannon, you know, and these guys, man. And I just remember working so hard to turn my reputation around. Because the first day in the academy, they said, your reputation is everything. If you destroy it, you will never get it back. And man, I was able to actually get my reputation back because I worked so hard to prove to these guys I can be trusted. I'm an honest person and I'm going to make sure that you feel safe on shift with me. That if anything happens, you know that I'm going to do whatever it takes to get you back home to your families. And man, I mean, and that's something I still take so personal today. It's my reputation and everything I do. And not just for me, but also for my family name and just for the profession in general. Because if there's one thing I can't stand, it's a cop that goes out of his way to do the wrong thing and puts himself before the badge and the people around him.
Yeah. Well, God bless. Yeah. I mean, how did you do it? How did you win back the trust?
I tell people it was doing the small things, like showing up to work early, being the first to volunteer for details that nobody wanted. And there's a saying, like, don't just stand around on a scene, find work. And I'll be like, hey, man, I'll take the crime scene log. Hey, I'll put up the crime scene tape. Hey, I got this gun here. I'll do this. Hey, what do you need? What do you need? What do you need, man? Hey, you want me to do this for you? You need to go grab lunch? What do you need, man? Hey, man, I need somebody to work for me Saturday. Hey, I'll work for you. I ain't got no family right now. I'll do the job. You go enjoy your family. I put myself in a situation to where I forced myself to do more and I became a selfless person and stopped focusing on myself. And I started focusing on what everybody else around me needed. So I took the attention off of my tragedy, my pain, and I turned it outwards to help the people around me. You know what I mean? I started getting involved in church again. You know, I mean, I started doing everything I could on my end. I started getting myself together physically. Like I had blew up to 350 pounds during this point in time. And I'm a diabetic. So, you know, leads us to say my doctor's not happy. And he's like, yo, man, he's like, you're going to die. And I was like, well, I hope so, you know, but it's a slow death. You know? And so I started running. And what really changed me physically was I remember we were on a run on 36th Street. It was a welfare check. And this family was like, hey, we haven't heard from Meemaw. This little old black grandma, and like I knock on the door, she comes to the door. She was just like, ain't you just the chunkiest little cop I've ever seen, baby? And man, oh, it was so embarrassing. And from that moment, that's when I started getting up at like 4 a.m. before my shift. And I would run 3 miles and then hit the gym, yo. And I mean, I had to literally recalculate my mind and change my mindset. To where, no, this is a job. I'm a cop. How can I help anybody if I'm sitting here 350 pounds and I can't run, I can't move, I can't breathe? You know? And so I literally I lost like 100 pounds. You know, and I became a new person all over again. You know, but the one thing that really helped me the most was my wife now. I reached out to her. You know, we weren't even dating. We hadn't even chatted in years, you know, and I reached out to her and we started chatting and talking, you know, and then the next thing you know, we fall in love. And but my relationship with her was built different than all my other previous marriages. This was a relationship built on God, built on Jesus Christ in the Bible, you know, and we formed this bond. And man, and ever since then, I mean, man, it's just been, I'm not going to say a perfect life, but man, there are people that would kill to have what I have. And I know that. And I'm aware of that. Like, I have a great life because I have a career I love. And I have a wonderful wife and I have wonderful children, you know, and I'm not going to say I don't take it for granted. I don't want to take it for granted, you know, because I know how hard I had to fight to get to where I am now, you know, and like, I just wake up every day like, man, I got a beautiful home in a great neighborhood. I mean, there's money in the account and there's food on the table. You know, and like my family wants for nothing. You know, and just I'm living this wonderful life in this great country. You know, I'm just sitting there like, man, like how did I make it? And I can only say by the grace of God, by God's mercy in my life, you know, and by, like I said, by taking the focus off of myself and learning to focus on other people around me and taking my tragedy and my pain and turn it into purpose to serve is like, is how I've gotten here to this point.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I'm struck by, here you were in the military, almost killed, praying to survive. And then you get to the point where you want to end your life. I mean, it's just,
you know, I've thought about that so many times, but that's just kind of the duality of life. It was just, I tell people, man, life is literally a roller coaster, man. It's there's going to be high points where you're going up the mountain. Everything's great and everything's fine. I mean, and everything's perfect, but rest assured you at a certain point in time, the bottom is going to fall out and you're going to coast down the bottom into the valley. But I tell people fruit does not grow on mountaintops, but you will find fruit in the valley. It's going to be dark, but you're going to have to do some work down there. But a lot of people get into the valley and it's dark, yo. And you just think, I thought that, I was like, in that moment of time, I just thought like, my life, the way it is now is how it's going to be forever. I'm never going to be happy. I'm always going to be fat and I'm always going to be ugly and I'm always going to be just miserable. You know, just this darkness that engulfed my life was my life. You do the work down in the valley and you slowly start to rise out of the valley. And then you'll slowly creep back up to the mountaintop and you'll enjoy that for a while. But guess what? God still has work to do on you. You're going to fall back into the valley. So it's just literally in life is learning to ride the waves up and down. No, I'm a big Dave Ramsey guy. I love Dave Ramsey, but he always says this quote. He says, nobody gets hurt riding on a roller coaster unless you jump off. Yo, so, and I'm just like, yeah, like, hey, just ride the waves, man. Just up and down, up and down. It's going to change.
That's good advice.
I have to remind myself still.
Well, one of the things that I was so happy to read was that your command staff, which you just referenced, took such a interest in you and concern and wrapped their arms around you and said, we love you and we're going to take care of you. Because too often I hear law enforcement say the command staff is out of touch with the rank and file and what they need. So I was thrilled to hear that they took care of you like that.
Yeah, but it's like, I tell people, man, that's the old guard. And this was 2010, 2011. And I tell people, the police department and the fabric of the police department has changed now. Like, so I'm no longer with Louisville Metro Police Department for that exact reason, because I don't trust the command that's there currently in place. I'm not saying that they're bad people, yo, but I don't know any other commander. Or, I mean, my major at the time, Major Christopher. I mean, even after he pulled me into his office, he sent me a text like, hey, let's meet up for coffee, man. Like, what? Like, meet up for coffee? You're a major. Bro, I'm nobody on this thing. But he just took such an interest in me. And I mean, then he's like, hey, man, I want you to come over for dinner one night and meet my family. And I'm sitting here.
That's amazing.
Oh, my God. I mean, and everybody's like, man, you know, all these old school officers are racist. I'm sitting here. My major's white. I'm just a black dude from, you know, Kentucky that was in the military. He was in the military, but he saw beyond the skin color and he said, you're a good dude. And I mean, he's a old school cop, man. I mean, I think he started in like the late 70s, you know what I mean? He just saw something in me. I mean, I'm just sitting there breaking bread with his family, and his family's just wrapping arms around me and loving me. And I was just like, man, this is what it's supposed to be. This is what a family unit is, you know? And nobody treated me any different. He just saw I was hurting and I needed some help, you know? But like I said, it's different nowadays where I don't feel like it's that anymore. And I get to, it's not that policing is a bad career, but I just think the people in policing now, it's just the fabric's changed. And I think everybody's more so kind of out for themselves now. And everybody's a bit more cautious. So everybody's trying to kind of like just trying to make sure they don't get fired so they can get their pension, which I don't blame anybody for that. I mean, yeah, hey, I understand, yo, but at a certain point, I said, you have to put others before yourself. Because, I mean, we are a profession where what we do is serve. When you elevate in policing, you become a commander. You're not there to be an overseer. You're there to be a servant to the people below you. That's what Jesus Christ said. He said, I came to serve, not be served. And I think too many of us nowadays in the profession, and we all know the people, man, the guys that promote so quickly and they weren't crap for cops on the street, you know, because They need a title and they need and crave and want respect and power. And we all know those people. And unfortunately, I feel like the promotion processes within the police department is so vague. You know, and they don't take the officer's, you know, entire career. They just look at, well, he got a 100 on this test. You know, yeah. Never mind what his constituents say about him being a coward on the street and not being able to fight his way out of a wet bag. But, yay, we're going to make this guy in command. He only has like 2 felony arrests in 3 years. We're going to make him commander. We're going to make him a sergeant and lead. And I'm just like, how can you lead a group of lions if you ain't never been a lion? You know, it just and that's what we got now. But we got a lot of sheep that have weaseled their way into command, and they're not warriors, and you're trying to be warriors, man. And that's that's the good thing about 2020. I saw, man, 2020 kind of revealed who was real, who was a real cop, who was a real phony, and it revealed who was only a cop for clout, because we had a lot of guys on Metro that. A lot of leaders, quote unquote leaders with stripes that were like, yo, bro, I'm out of here. Dog. Yeah, I'm now, man. And you saw who were the true leaders in that point in time, yo. And you saw who was became who was a cop because they wanted to be a cop. Like, I was excited to be in 2020. I was like, all right, bro, you know what? Let's do it, man. Let's do it. Yeah. Like, I operate well in chaos. You know, yeah. I welcome the chaos. You know, like it gets old sometimes, but at the end of the day, that's why I'm a street cop, man. I like the unpredictability of it, yo. And that just, it gets spicy and it keeps my blood flowing. It makes me feel young.
Good. I do want to touch on Border Patrol and then come back to 2020.
Absolutely.
In part 2 of our conversation, we get into why Dexter chose to become a Border Patrol agent and what the job really is. Then we get to 2020 and how the riots were what drew Dexter back to police work and back to LMPD. We discuss race, media bias in their coverage of police incidents, and what it's like to be in law enforcement in 2024. Here's a sneak peek.
Like I said, I'm an idealist, and so when I saw Border Patrol agents on TV, it looked like policing. And I had a buddy that was Border Patrol, and I remember watching the shows on National Geographic, like, bro, these guys are in the mountains chasing people, carrying rifles, yo, and doing all this cool stuff, propelling from helicopters and riding ATVs. And I'm like, oh, man. I was like, that looks so dope. And then I looked at the pay, like, bro, how much are they paying? What? To run around the desert with a rifle? I was like, bro, I did that for a lot less in Iraq. When George Floyd broke out, yo, I was like, man, I was looking at Minneapolis like, that ain't going to happen in Louisville. And I remember seeing on the first night the crowd gathered downtown in Louisville. Yo, and I was just like, it ain't going to happen, bro. And the next thing you know, I just see this giant rock on the news just come crashing in to the downtown area patrol office, where was my last assignment. And I just saw that window shattered and I said, oh, crap. And then just chaos ensued. And I just felt so much guilt for leaving them behind. Yo, and I was like, man, I gotta go home. Well, we're seeing where history is 4 years later. And look at America, look at policing, and look at departments across the nation. Can you, anybody sit here, listen to this, and tell me that America is better 4 years later after all this chaos? Do you feel safer in your communities? Do you feel safer knowing that there's less cops out on the street? Do you feel safer overall and in general? If anybody says yes, you are out of your mind and lying to yourself.
I hope you'll join us. To learn more about Dexter, check out his website, iampitz.com. You can buy his book, I Am Pitz, Memoirs of an American Patriot, and you can find his I Am Pitz podcast, which is available on all podcast platforms. Dexter is on Instagram at iampitz1, the numeral 1, and on TikTok at iampitzbook. All those links will be in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you in the next episode.